Chapter 23, Dharma Nectar. It was the Buddha's custom to rise early and to sit in meditation, and then do walking meditation among the forest trees. One morning, while walking, he saw a handsome, elegantly dressed man in his late 20s, half hidden in the morning mist. The Buddha sat on a large rock, and when the man approached quite close to the rock, still unaware of the Buddha, he mumbled, "Disgusting, repulsive." The Buddha spoke up. "There is nothing disgusting. There is nothing repulsive." The man stopped in his tracks. The Buddha's voice was clear and soothing, and the man looked up to see the Buddha sitting there, relaxed and serene. The young man removed his sandals and bowed deeply before the Buddha. Then he sat on a nearby rock. The Buddha asked, "What is so disgusting? What is so repulsive?" The young man introduced himself as Yasa, the son of one of the wealthiest and most reputable merchants in Varanasi. Yasa had always enjoyed a life of splendor and ease. His parents catered to his every whim, providing him with every kind of pleasure, including a handsome manor, jewels, money, wine, courtesans, banquets, and parties. But Yasa, a sensitive and thoughtful young man, had begun to feel suffocated by this life of pleasure and could no longer find any contentment in it. He was like a person locked in a room without windows. He longed for some fresh air, for a simple, wholesome life. The night before, Yasa and some friends had gathered to feast, drink, play music, and be entertained by lovely young courtesans. In the middle of the night, Yasa woke up and looked at his friends and the young women sprawled out asleep. At that moment, he knew he could not continue to behave that way. He threw a cloak over his body, slipped on a pair of sandals, and walked out the front gate, not even knowing where he would go. He had wandered aimlessly all night, until by chance he found himself in the deer park of Isipatana. And now, as the sun rose, he sat facing the Buddha. The Buddha counseled him, "Yasa, this life is filled with suffering, but it is also filled with many wonders. To drown in sensual pleasures is bad for the health of both body and mind. If you live simply and wholesomely, not ruled by desires, it is possible to experience the many wonders of life. Yasa, look around you. Can you see the trees standing in the morning mists? Are they not beautiful? The moon, the stars, the rivers, the mountains, the sunlight, the songs of birds, and the sounds of bubbling springs are all manifestations of a universe that can provide us with endless happiness. The happiness we receive from these things nourishes mind and body. Close your eyes and breathe in and out a few times. Now open them. What do you see? Trees, mist, sky, rays of sunlight. Your own two eyes are wonders. Because you have been out of touch with wonders like these, you have come to despise your mind and body. Some people despise their own minds and bodies so much they want to commit suicide. They see only the suffering in life. But suffering is not the true nature of the universe. Suffering is the result of the way we live and of our erroneous understanding of life." The Buddha's words touched Yasa like fresh drops of cool dew to soothe his parched heart. Overcome with happiness, he prostrated before the Buddha and asked to become a disciple. The Buddha helped him up and said, "A monk lives a simple and humble life. He has no money. He sleeps in a grass hut or beneath the trees. He eats only what he receives from begging, and he eats only one meal a day. Can you live such a life?" "Yes, master, I would be happy to live such a life." The Buddha continued, "A monk devotes his mind and body to realize liberation in order to help himself and all others. He concentrates his efforts to help relieve suffering. Do you vow to follow such a path?" "Yes, master, I vow to follow such a path." "Then I accept you as my disciple. A disciple in my community is known as a bhikkhu, a beggar. Every day you will go to beg your food in order to nourish yourself, to practice humility, and to be in touch with others in order to show them the way." Just then the Buddha's five friends and first disciples appeared. Yasa stood up and respectfully greeted each one. The Buddha introduced them to Yasa and then turned to Kondana. "Kondana, Yasa wishes to become a bhikkhu. I have accepted him. Please show him how to wear a robe, carry a begging bowl, observe his breath, and do sitting and walking meditation. Yasa bowed to the Buddha and then followed Kundana, who led him to his hut, where he shaved Yasa's hair and gave him instruction according to the Buddha's wishes. Kundana happened to have an extra robe and bowl, which had been offered to him, but which he had never used. He gave these to Yasa. That afternoon, Yasa's father came looking for him. All morning long, the household had frantically been seeking Yasa at his father's orders. One servant followed Yasa's footprints to the deer park, and there he found Yasa's golden sandals abandoned by a large rock. After making inquiries, he learned that his young master was staying there with some monks. He returned in haste to inform Yasa's father. When Yasa's father arrived, he found the Buddha sitting serenely on a rock. He joined his palms and respectfully asked, "Revered monk, have you seen my son Yasa?" The Buddha motioned to a nearby rock and invited Yasa's father to be seated. He said, "Yasa is in the hut and will be out shortly." Yasa's father listened as the Buddha recounted all that had taken place that morning. The Buddha helped him understand Yasa's inner thoughts and aspirations. "Yasa is a bright and sensitive young man. He has found the path of liberation for his heart. He now has faith, peace, and joy. Please be happy for him," the Buddha said. The Buddha also told Yasa's father how it was possible. That could reduce suffering and anxiety and create peace and joy for oneself and all those around one. The merchant felt lighter with each word the Buddha spoke. He stood up and joined his palms together to ask to be accepted as a lay disciple. The Buddha was silent for a moment, and then he spoke, "My disciples strive to live simply with awareness, avoid killing, shun adultery, speak truthfully, and avoid alcohol and stimulants which cloud the mind. Sir, if you feel you can follow such a path, I will accept you as a lay disciple." Yasa's father knelt before the Buddha and joined his palms. "Allow me to take refuge in your teaching. Please show me the way in this life. I vow to remain faithful to your teaching all my days." The Buddha helped the merchant back to his feet. Yasa joined them. He was clad in a bhikkhu's robe, and his head was shaven. The new bhikkhu smiled with rare joy. He joined his palms to make a lotus bud, and then bowed to his father. Yasa looked radiant. His father had never seen him so happy. Yasa's father bowed to his son and said, "Your mother is at home, and she is very worried about you." Yasa answered, "I will visit her to relieve her worries. But I have taken vows to follow the Buddha and to live a life of service to all beings." Yasa's father turned to the Buddha. "Please, Master, allow me to invite you and your bhikkhus to have a meal at my house tomorrow. We would be deeply honored if you would come instruct us on the path of awakening." The Buddha turned and looked at Yasa. The new bhikkhu's eyes sparkled. Then the Buddha nodded his acceptance. The following day, the Buddha and his six bhikkhus ate at the home of Yasa's parents. Yasa's mother wept, so overcome was she to see her son both safe and happy. The Buddha and his bhikkhus were invited to sit on cushioned chairs. Yasa's mother served them herself. As the bhikkhus ate in silence, no one spoke, not even the household servants. When the meal was finished and the begging bowls had been washed, Yasa's parents bowed to the Buddha and then sat on low stools placed before him. The Buddha taught them the five precepts, which formed the foundation of practice for lay disciples. The first precept is, do not kill. All living beings fear death. If we truly follow the path of understanding and love, we will observe this precept. Not only should we protect the lives of humans, we should protect the lives of animals as well. Observing this precept nourishes compassion and wisdom. The second precept is, do not steal. We do not have the right to steal the property of others, nor to gain wealth by taking advantage of the labor of others. We must find ways to help others support themselves. The third precept is, do not engage in sexual misconduct. Do not violate the rights and commitments of others. Always remain faithful to your spouse. The fourth precept is, do not say untruthful things. Do not utter words that distort the truth or cause discord and hatred. Do not spread news that you do not know to be certain. The fifth precept is, do not use alcohol or any other stimulants. If you live by the spirit of the five precepts, you will avoid suffering and discord for yourself, your family, and your friends. You will find your happiness in life multiplied many times over. As Yasa's mother listened to the Buddha, she felt as though a gate of happiness had just opened in her heart. She was happy to know that her husband had already been accepted as a lay disciple by the Buddha. She knelt before the Buddha and joined her palms. She, too, was accepted as a lay disciple. The Buddha and his six bhikkhus returned to Isipatana. Chapter 24. Taking Refuge. News of Yasa becoming a bhikkhu spread quickly among his friends. His closest companions, Vimala, Subahu, Punaji, and Gavampati, decided to visit him at Isipatana. On the way there, Subahu said, "If Yasa has decided to become a monk, his master must be really extraordinary, and the path he teaches most lofty. Yasa is very discriminating." Vimala retorted, "Don't be so certain. Perhaps he's become a monk on a whim, and it won't last long. After 6 months or a year, he may very well abandon such a life." Gavampati disagreed. "You're not taking Yasa seriously enough. I've always found him to be quite serious, and I'm sure he wouldn't do anything like this without sincerely intending it." When they found Yasa at the deer park, he introduced them to the Buddha. "Teacher, these four friends of mine are all fine persons. Please have compassion and open their eyes to the path of liberation." The Buddha sat down to talk with the four young men. At first, Vimala was the most skeptical, but the more he heard, the more impressed he became. Finally, he suggested to the other three that they all ask the Buddha to accept them as bhikkhus. The four young men knelt before the Buddha. Recognizing their sincerity, the Buddha accepted them on the spot. He asked Kondana to give them basic instruction. Yasa had several hundred other friends who soon heard how Yasa and his four closest companions had all become bhikkhus. 120 of these young men, all in their 20s, met outside Yasa's home and decided to visit Isipatana that very morning. Yasa was informed of their arrival, and he came out to greet them. He spoke about his decision to become a bhikkhu, and then he led them to have an audience with the Buddha. Surrounded by the young men, the Buddha spoke about the path which can end suffering and lead to peace and joy. He told them about his own search and how he had vowed to find the way while he was still a young man. The 120 young men listened as if entranced. 50 of them requested to become bhikkhus at once. Many of the other 70 also wanted to become bhikkhus, but could not abandon their responsibilities as sons, husbands, and fathers. Yasa asked the Buddha to accept his 50 friends, and the Buddha agreed. Overjoyed, Yasa said, "With your permission, tomorrow I will pass by my parents' home when I am out begging. I can ask them if they might like to offer robes and bowls to these new bhikkhus." The Buddha now had 60 bhikkhus living with him at the deer park. He remained there for 3 additional months in order to guide the community. During that time, several hundred men and women were accepted by the Buddha as lay disciples. The Buddha taught the bhikkhus how to practice observing their bodies, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. He taught them about the interdependent nature of all things, and explained that meditating on interdependence was very important. He explained that all things depend on each other for their arising, development, and decline. Without dependent co-arising, nothing could exist. Within one thing existed all things. The meditation on dependent co-arising, he said, is a gate that leads to liberation from birth and death. It has the power to break through fixed and narrow views, such as the belief that the universe has been created either by some god or from some element such as earth, water, fire, or air. The Buddha understood his responsibility as a teacher. He cared for and guided the 60 bhikkhus like a loving elder brother. He also shared a lot of responsibility with his first 5 disciples. Kondana guided 20 young men, while Badiya, Vapa, Mahanama, and Asaji each helped guide 10 young men. All the bhikkhus made great progress along the path. When When the Buddha saw this, he called the community together and said, Bhikkhus, please listen. We are totally free, not bound by anything. You understand the path now. Proceed with confidence and you will make great strides. You can leave Isipatthana whenever you like. Walk as free persons and share the way of awakening with others. Please sow the seeds of liberation and enlightenment to bring peace and joy to others. Teach the path of liberation, which is beautiful from beginning to end in form and content. Countless others will benefit from your work of spreading the Dharma. As for me, I will leave soon. I plan to head east. I want to visit the Bodhi tree and the children in Uruvela village. Afterward, I will go to visit a special friend in Rajagaha. After listening to the Buddha's words, a large number of bhikkhus, clad in brick-colored robes and carrying just their begging bowls, left to go spread the teaching. Only 20 bhikkhus remained in Isipatthana. Before long, many people in the kingdoms of Kasi and Magadha heard about the Buddha and his disciples. They knew that a prince of the Sakya clan had attained liberation and was teaching his path in Isipatthana, near the city of Varanasi. Many monks, who up to then had not yet attained the fruits of liberation, felt greatly encouraged, and they came from all directions to Isipatthana. After hearing the Buddha speak, most took vows to become bhikkhus. The bhikkhus who had left Isipatthana to spread the teaching brought back many more young men who also wished to become monks. The number of disciples soon swelled. One day the Buddha gathered the Sangha in the deer park and said, Bhikkhus, it is no longer necessary for me personally to ordain every new bhikkhu or for everyone who wishes to be ordained to come to Isipatthana. Those who wish to receive ordination should be able to do so in their own villages, in the presence of their friends and families. And like you, I too would like to be free to remain here and to travel from here. Henceforth, when you meet a sincere and aspiring new bhikkhu, you may ordain him wherever you may be. Kondana stood up and joined his party. Master, please show us the way to organize a ceremony of ordination. Then we can do it by ourselves in the future. The Buddha answered, Please do as I have done in the past. Asaji stood up and said, Master, your presence is so formidable, you do not need to perform a formal ceremony. But for the rest of us, a formal procedure is needed. Brother Kondana, perhaps you can suggest a form. The Buddha is here with us, and he can add to your suggestions. Kondana was silent for a moment. Then he spoke. Respected Buddha, I think the first step should be to have the aspiring bhikkhu allow his hair and beard to be shaved. Then he can be instructed in the manner of wearing the robe. After he has put on his robe, he can expose his right shoulder in the customary manner and kneel before the monk giving the ordination. It is proper to kneel as the monk giving the ordination is serving as the representative of the Buddha. The one being ordained can hold his palms together like a lotus bud and recite 3 times, I take refuge in the Buddha, the one who shows me the way in this life. I take refuge in the Dharma, the way of understanding and love. I take refuge in the Sangha, the community that lives in harmony and awareness. After repeating these refuges, he will be considered a bhikkhu in the community of the Buddha. But this is only my poor suggestion. Please, teacher, correct it. The Buddha answered, It is most fine. Brother Kondana, reciting the 3 refuges 3 times while kneeling before an already ordained bhikkhu shall be sufficient to become an ordained bhikkhu. The community was happy with this decision. A few days later, the Buddha put on his robe, lifted his bowl, and left Isipatthana on his own. It was an especially beautiful morning. He headed toward the Ganga River to return to Magadha. Chapter 25. Music's Lofty Peaks. The Buddha had traveled the road from Varanasi to Rajagaha before. He walked slowly and enjoyed the surrounding forests and rice fields. Toward noon, he stopped to beg in a small hamlet by the roadside. He then entered the forest to eat quietly, and then did walking meditation right there. When he was finished, he sat beneath a shady tree to meditate. He enjoyed being alone in the forest. After he had meditated for some hours, A group of well-dressed young men passed by, obviously agitated over something. Several of them clutched musical instruments. The young man at the head of their party bowed his head to greet the Buddha and then asked, "Monk, did you see a girl run by here?" The Buddha asked, "Why do you wish to find her?" The young man recounted their story from the beginning. They were from the city of Varanasi and had entered the forest that morning on a pleasure outing, bringing with them their musical instruments and a young woman to entertain them. When they had finished singing, dancing, and feasting, they stretched out on the forest floor to take a nap. But when they awoke, they discovered that the young girl had stolen their jewelry and disappeared. They had been chasing after her ever since. The Buddha looked calmly at the young men and asked, "Tell me, friends, is it better in this moment to find the young woman or to find your own selves?" The young men were startled. The Buddha's radiant appearance and his unusual question brought them back to themselves. The first young man answered, "Respected teacher, perhaps we should try to find ourselves first." The Buddha said, "Life can be found only in the present moment, but our minds rarely dwell in the present moment. Instead, we chase after the past or long for the future. We think we are being ourselves, but in fact, we almost never are in real contact with ourselves. Our minds are too busy chasing after yesterday's memories or tomorrow's dreams. The only way to be in touch with life is to return to the present moment. Once you know how to return to the present moment, you'll become awakened, and at that moment you will find your true self. Look at these tender leaves caressed by the sunlight. Have you ever really looked at the green of the leaves with a serene and awakened heart? This shade of green is one of the wonders of life. If you have never really looked at it, please do so now." The young men grew very quiet. With their eyes following the Buddha's pointing finger, each of them looked at the green leaves gently swaying in the afternoon breeze. A moment later, the Buddha turned to the youth sitting on his right and said, "I see you have a flute. Please, play something for us." The youth felt shy, but he lifted his flute to his lips and began to play. Everyone listened attentively. The flute's sound was like the lamenting cry of a disappointed lover. The Buddha's eyes did not waver from the young man playing the flute. When he finished his song, sadness seemed to veil the afternoon forest. Still no one spoke, until suddenly the young man held out his flute to the Buddha and said, "Respected monk, please play for us." The Buddha smiled as several of the young men burst out laughing, taking their friend for a real fool. Who ever heard of a monk playing the flute? But to their surprise, the Buddha took the flute in his hands. The young men all turned their eyes to the Buddha, unable to mask their curiosity. The Buddha took several deep breaths and then raised the flute to his lips. The image of a young man playing the flute long ago in the royal gardens of Kapilavatthu arose in the Buddha's mind. It was a full moon night. He could see Mahaprajapati sitting on a stone bench, quietly listening. And there was Yasodhara with her freshly lit incense holder of fragrant sandalwood. The Buddha began to play the flute. The sound was as delicate as a thin strand of smoke curling gently from the roof of a simple dwelling outside Kapilavatthu at the hour of the evening meal. Slowly the thin strand expanded across space like a gathering of clouds, which in turn transformed into a thousand-petaled lotus, each petal a different shimmering color. It seemed that one flutist suddenly had become 10,000 flutists, and all the wonders of the universe had been transformed into sounds, sounds of a thousand colors and forms, sounds as light as a breeze and quick as the pattering of rain, clear as a crane flying overhead, intimate as a lullaby, bright as a shining jewel, and subtle as the smile of one who has transcended all thoughts of gain and loss. The birds of the forest stopped singing in order to listen to this sublime music, and even the breezes ceased rustling the leaves. The forest was enveloped in an atmosphere of total peace, serenity, and wonder. The young men sitting around the Buddha felt completely refreshed, and they now dwelled completely in the present moment, in touch with all the wonders of the trees, the Buddha, the flute, and each other's friendship. Even after the Buddha put the flute down, they could still hear the music. Not one of the young men thought about the young woman or the jewels she had stolen. No one spoke for a long time. Then the young man to whom the flute belonged asked the Buddha, "Master, you play so wonderfully. I've never heard anyone who could play so well. Who did you study with? Would you accept me as your student so that I could learn flute from you?" The Buddha smiled, and he said, "I learned to play the flute when I was a boy, but I have not played in nearly 7 years. My sound, however, is better than it was before." "How can that be, Master? How can your playing have improved if you have not practiced in 7 years?" "Playing the flute does not depend solely on practicing the flute. I now play better than in the past because I have found my true self. You cannot reach lofty heights in art if you do not first discover the unsurpassable beauty in your own heart. If you would like to play the flute truly well, you must find your true self on the path of awakening." The Buddha explained the path of liberation, the Four Noble Truths, and the Noble Eightfold Path. The young men listened intently. Finished speaking, every one of them knelt down and asked to be accepted as a disciple. The Buddha ordained them all. He then instructed them to make their way to Isipatana and introduce themselves to the Bhikkhu Kondana, who would give them guidance in the practice of the way. The Buddha told them he would see them again before long. That night, the Buddha slept alone in the forest. The next morning, he crossed the Ganga and headed east. He wanted to visit the children of Uruvela before making his way to Rajagaha to see King Bimbisara. Chapter 26. Water Rises Too. 7 days later, the Buddha was happy to find himself back in the forest of the Bodhi tree. He rested the night there. In the morning, he surprised Svasti by the banks of the Niranjara River. They sat for a long while along the shore before the Buddha told Svasti he should continue cutting the kusa grass needed by the buffaloes. He also helped Svasti cut some grass. Then, bidding Svasti goodbye, he walked to the village to beg. The next afternoon, the village children came to visit the Buddha in the forest. All of Svasti's family was there. Sujata brought along her friends. The children were very happy to see the Buddha again. They listened intently while he told them all that had happened to him in the past year. The Buddha promised Svasti that when Svasti was 20 years old, the Buddha would accept him as a bhikkhu. By that time, Svasti's sisters and brothers would be old enough to care for themselves. The children told the Buddha that over the past few months, a spiritual community led by a Brahmin had settled nearby. There were 500 devotees in all. They did not shave their heads like the bhikkhus. Instead, their hair was braided and then piled on top of their heads. They worshipped the god of fire. The Brahmin's name was Kassapa. He was deeply revered by all who met him. The following morning, the Buddha crossed the river and found Master Kassapa's community. His devotees lived in simple huts made from leafy branches and wore clothes made from the bark of trees. They did not enter the village to beg, but accepted offerings brought to them by the villagers. In addition, they raised their own animals for food and for making sacrifices. The Buddha stopped to speak with one of Kassapa's followers, who told him that Kassapa was deeply versed in the Vedas and lived a life of utmost virtue. Kassapa, he explained, also had 2 younger brothers who also led communities of fire worship. All 3 brothers held fire to be the original essence of the universe. Uruvela Kassapa was deeply loved by his 2 brothers, Nadi Kassapa, who lived with 300 devotees along the Niranjara about a day's travel north, and Gaya Kassapa, who led 200 devotees in Gaya. Kassapa's disciple led the Buddha to his master's hut so that the Buddha could have an audience with him. Although Kassapa was no longer a young man, he was still quick and alert. When he saw the young teacher's extraordinary bearing, he felt immediately drawn to him and treated him as a special guest. Kassapa invited the Buddha to sit on a stump outside the hut, and the 2 enjoyed a long conversation. Kassapa marveled at how deeply versed the Buddha was in the Vedas. He was further astounded to discover that this young monk had grasped certain concepts in the Vedas that had eluded his own understanding. The Buddha helped explain certain of the most profound passages in the Atharveda and Rig Veda scriptures that Kasapa thought he had understood, but discovered he had not yet truly grasped. Even more amazing was the young monk's knowledge of history, doctrine, and Brahmanic rituals. That noon, the Buddha accepted Uruvela Kasapa's invitation to have a meal with him. The Buddha neatly folded his outer robe into a cushion and sat upon it, eating in mindful silence. So impressed was Uruvela Kasapa by the Buddha's serene and majestic countenance that he did not break the silence. That afternoon, they continued their conversation. The Buddha asked, "Master Kasapa, can you explain to me how worshipping fire can lead a person to liberation?" Uruvela Kasapa did not answer right away. He knew very well that a superficial or ordinary response would not suffice for this extraordinary young monk. Kasapa began by explaining that fire was the basic essence of the universe. It had its source in Brahma. The main altar of the community, the fire sanctuary, always kept a sacred fire burning. That fire was itself the image of Brahma. The Atharveda scripture spoke of fire worship. Fire was life. Without fire, there could be no life. Fire was light, warmth, and the source of the sun, which enabled plants, animals, and people to live. It chased away dark shadows, conquered the cold, and brought joy and vitality to all beings. Food was made edible by fire, and thanks to fire, people were reunited with Brahma at death. Because fire was the source of life, it was Brahma himself. Agni, the god of fire, was one of the thousands of manifestations of Brahma. On the fire altar, Agni was portrayed as having two heads. One symbolized the daily uses of fire, and the other symbolized the fire of sacrifice and returning to the source of life. The fire worshippers performed 40 sacrificial rites. A devotee in their community had to observe precepts, practice austerities, and pray diligently in order to follow the path that would one day lead to liberation. Kasapa was strongly opposed to those Brahmins who used their position in society to acquire wealth and lose themselves in pursuit of sensual pleasures. He said that such Brahmins only performed rituals and recited the scriptures in order to become rich. Because of that, the reputation of the traditional Brahmanic path had become tarnished. The Buddha asked, "Master Kasapa, what do you think of those who regard water as the fundamental essence of life, who say that water is the element that purifies and returns people to union with Brahma?" Kasapa hesitated. He thought of the hundreds of thousands of people, right at that very moment, who were bathing themselves in the waters of Ganga and other sacred rivers to purify themselves. "Gautama, water cannot really help one attain liberation. Water naturally flows down. Only fire rises. When we die, our body rises in smoke thanks to fire." "Master Kasapa, that is not accurate. The white clouds floating above are also a form of water. Thus, water rises too. Indeed, smoke itself is no more than evaporated water. Both clouds and smoke will eventually return to a liquid state. All things, as I'm sure you know, move in cycles. But all things share one fundamental essence, and all things return to that one essence. Master Kasapa, all things depend on all other things for their existence. Take, for example, this leaf in my hand. Earth, water, heat, seed, tree, clouds, sun, time, space. All these elements have enabled this leaf to come into existence. If just one of these elements was missing, the leaf could not exist. All beings, organic and inorganic, rely on the law of dependent co-arising. The source of one thing is all things. Please consider this carefully. Don't you see that this leaf I am now holding in my hand is only here thanks to the interpenetration of all the phenomena in the universe, including your own awareness?" It was already evening and beginning to grow dark. Kasapa invited the Buddha to sleep in his own hut. It was the first time he had ever made such an offer to anyone. But then he had never before met such an extraordinary monk. But the Buddha refused, saying that he had grown accustomed to sleeping alone at night. He said he would like to sleep in the fire sanctuary, if that would be all right. The Brahmin said, "For the past several days, an enormous snake has taken refuge in the fire sanctuary. All efforts to chase it away have failed. You must not sleep there, friend Gautama. It might be dangerous." We have even been holding our ceremonies outside for fear of the snake. Please, sleep in my hut for your own safety. The Buddha replied, Don't worry. I want to sleep in the fire sanctuary. I will not be in any danger. The Buddha recalled all the months he had practiced austerities in the wild jungles. Wild beasts passed him by without harming him. Sometimes, while he sat in meditation, enormous snakes slithered in front of him. He knew that if you took care not to frighten such animals, they would not harm you. Seeing that the Buddha could not be dissuaded, Kassapa said, If you wish to sleep in the fire sanctuary, you shall. You may sleep there as many nights as you like. That night, the Buddha entered the fire sanctuary. On the central altar burned a great fire fed by many candles. On one side of the room was a pile of sandalwood logs, which were used for outdoor ceremonies. The Buddha guessed that the snake was probably curled up in the wood pile, so he sat in meditation on the other side of the room, using his folded robe as a cushion. He meditated deep into the night. Toward the end of his meditation, he saw the great snake coiled in the center of the room looking at him. The Buddha spoke softly to it. Dear friend, return to the jungle for your own safety. The Buddha's voice was filled with love and understanding. The snake slowly uncoiled itself and crept out the door. The Buddha stretched out and fell asleep. When he awoke, brilliant moonlight poured through the window onto his sleeping place. The 18th day moon was unusually bright. He thought how pleasant it would be to do walking meditation beneath its light. He shook off the dust from his outer room and put it on before walking out of the fire sanctuary. In the early hours of the morning, the sanctuary somehow caught on fire. Those who saw it first shouted to all the others. Everyone filled buckets with water at the river's edge, but to no avail. The water came too late to extinguish the raging fire. At last, the 500 devotees could do no more than stand and watch their sanctuary burn to the ground. Oruvela Kassapa stood with his followers. His heart was heavy with grief as he thought of the virtuous and talented young monk he had met only the day before. The young monk had surely perished in the fire. If only Gautama had consented to sleep in his hut, he would still be alive. Just as he was thinking this, the Buddha appeared. The Buddha had seen the fire from where he had been walking in the hills, and he had returned to see if he could be of any assistance. Overcome with relief and joy, Kassapa ran to the Buddha and grasped his hand. Thank goodness you are alive, friend Gautama. Nothing has happened to you. I am so happy. The Buddha placed his hands on the Brahmin's shoulders and smiled. Thank you, my friend. Yes, I am all right. The Buddha knew that on that day Uruvela Kassapa would give a discourse, and that in addition to his own 500 disciples, at least 1,000 others would attend from the neighboring villages. The lecture would take place after the noon meal. Sensing that his presence during the lecture might cause Kassapa some discomfort, the Buddha went begging down in the village. After receiving food offerings, he walked to the lotus pond, ate his meal there, and spent the entire afternoon at that pleasant place. Late in the afternoon, Kassapa came looking for him. When he found him by the pond, he said, Friend Gautama, we waited for you at the noon meal, but you never appeared. Why didn't you join us? The Buddha responded that he had wished to be absent during the lecture. Why did you not wish to attend the lecture? Asked Uruvela Kassapa. The Buddha only smiled gently. The Brahmin did not say anything else. He knew that the young monk had read his thoughts. How tactful and considerate Gautama was! They sat by the lotus pond and conversed. Kassapa said, Yesterday you said that the presence of a leaf resulted from the coming together of many different conditions. You said that humans too exist only because of the coming together of many other conditions. But when all these conditions cease to be, where does the self go? The Buddha answered, For a long time humans have been trapped by the concept of Atman, the concept of a separate and eternal self. We have believed that when our body dies, this self continues to exist and seeks union with its source, which is Brahma. But friend Kassapa, that is a fundamental misunderstanding, which has caused countless generations to go astray. You should know, friend Kassapa, that all things exist because of interdependence, and all things cease to be because of interdependence. This is because that is. This is not because that is not. This is born because that is born. This dies because that dies. This is the wonderful law of dependent co-arising, which I have discovered in my meditation. In truth, there is nothing that is separate and eternal. There is no self, whether a higher or a lower self. Kasapa, have you ever meditated on your body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness? A person is made up of these five aggregates. They are continuously changing rivers in which one cannot find even one permanent element. Uruvela Kasapa remained silent for a long moment. Then he asked, "Could one say, then, that you teach the doctrine of non-being?" The Buddha smiled and shook his head. "No. The concept of non-being is one narrow view among a whole forest of narrow views. The concept of non-being is just as false as the concept of a separate, permanent self. Kasapa, look at the surface of this lotus pond. I do not say that the water and lotus do not exist. I only say that the water and the lotus arise thanks to the presence and interpenetration of all other elements, none of which are separate or permanent." Kasapa lifted his head and looked into the Buddha's eyes. "If there is no self, no Atman, why should one practice a spiritual path in order to attain liberation? Who will be liberated?" The Buddha looked deeply into the eyes of his Brahmana friend. His gaze was as radiant as the sun and as gentle as the soft moonlight. He smiled and said, "Kasapa, look for the answer within yourself." They returned together to Kasapa's community. Uruvela Kasapa insisted on giving the Buddha his hut for the night and went to sleep himself in the hut of one of his senior disciples. The Buddha could see how deeply Kasapa's disciples revered their teacher. Chapter 27. All Dharmas Are on Fire. Every morning Kasapa brought the Buddha some food, and so the Buddha did not need to go begging in the village. After his daily meal, he walked alone on forest paths or down to the lotus pond. In the later afternoons, Kasapa would join him for discussion beneath the trees or beside the pond. The more time he spent with the Buddha, the more Kasapa understood how wise and virtuous the Buddha was. One night it rained so heavily that by morning the Niranjara River had overflowed its banks. Nearby fields and dwellings were quickly submerged by floodwaters. Desperate villagers took boats out to try to rescue people. Kasapa's community was able to climb to higher land in time, but no one could find Gautama. Kasapa sent several boats to look for him. At last he was found standing on a distant hill. The water subsided as quickly as it had risen. The next morning the Buddha took his begging bowl and went down into the village to see how the villagers had fared in the flood. Luckily, no one had drowned. The people told the Buddha that because they did not own many possessions in the first place, the flood had not robbed them of much. Kasapa's disciples began to rebuild the fire sanctuary, which had been destroyed by fire, and to rebuild their huts washed away by the flood. One afternoon, while the Buddha and Kasapa stood along the banks of the Niranjara, Kasapa said, "Gautama, the other day you spoke about the meditation on one's body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. I have been practicing that meditation, and I have begun to understand how one's feelings and perceptions determine the quality of one's life. I also see that there is no permanent element to be found in any of the five rivers. I can even see that the belief in a separate self is false. But I still don't understand why one should follow a spiritual path if there is no self. Who is there to be liberated?" The Buddha asked, "Kasapa, do you accept that suffering is a truth?" "Yes, Gautama, I accept that suffering is a truth." "Do you agree that suffering has causes?" "Yes, I accept that suffering has causes." "Kasapa, when the causes of suffering are present, suffering is present. When the causes of suffering are removed, suffering is also removed." "Yes, I see that when the causes of suffering are removed, suffering itself is removed." "The cause of suffering is ignorance, a false way of looking at reality. Thinking the impermanent is permanent, that is ignorance. Thinking there is a self when there is not, that is ignorance. From ignorance is born greed, anger, fear, jealousy, and countless other sufferings. The path of liberation is the path of looking deeply at things in order to truly realize the nature of impermanence, the absence of a separate self, and the interdependence of all things. This path is the path that overcomes ignorance. Once ignorance is overcome, suffering is transcended. That is true liberation. There is no need for a self for there to be liberation. Uruvela Kassapa sat silently for a moment and then said, Gautama, I know you speak only from your own direct experience. Your words do not simply express concepts. You have said that liberation can only be attained through the efforts of meditation, by looking deeply at things. Do you think that all ceremonies, rituals, and prayers are useless? The Buddha pointed to the other side of the river and said, Kassapa, if a person wants to cross to the other shore, what should he do? If the water is shallow enough, he can wade across. Otherwise, he will have to swim or row a boat across. I agree. But what if he is unwilling to wade, swim, or row a boat? What if he just stands on this side of the river and prays to be on the other shore to come to him? What would you think of such a man? I would say he was being quite foolish. Just so, Kassapa. If one doesn't overcome ignorance and mental obstructions, one cannot cross to the other side to liberation, even if one spends one's whole life praying. Suddenly, Kassapa burst into tears and prostrated himself before the Buddha's feet. Gautama, I have wasted more than half my life. Please accept me as your disciple and give me the chance to study and practice the way of liberation with you. The Buddha helped Kassapa stand back up and said, I would not hesitate to accept you as my disciple, but what of your 500 devotees? Who will guide them if you leave? Kassapa answered, Gautama, give me a chance to speak with him this morning. Tomorrow afternoon I will let you know of my decision. The Buddha said, The children in Uruvela village call me the Buddha. Kassapa was surprised. That means the awakened one, doesn't it? I will call you the same. The next morning, the Buddha went begging in Uruvela village. Afterward, he went to the lotus pond to sit. Late that afternoon, Kassapa came looking for him. He told the Buddha that all 500 of his devotees agreed to become disciples under the Buddha's guidance. The next day, Uruvela Kassapa and all his followers shaved their heads and threw the locks of hair into the Niranjara River, along with all the liturgical objects they had used for fire worship. They bowed before the Buddha and recited three times, I take refuge in the Buddha, the one who shows me the way in this life. I take refuge in the Dharma, the way of understanding and love. I take refuge in the Sangha, the community that lives in harmony and awareness. The recitation of the three refuges echoed throughout the forest. When the ordination was completed, the Buddha spoke to the new bhikkhus about the Four Noble Truths and how to observe one's breath, body, and mind. He showed them how to beg for food and how to eat in silence. He asked them to release all the animals they had once raised for food and sacrifices. That afternoon, the Buddha met with Kassapa and 10 of Kassapa's senior students to teach them the fundamentals of the Way of Awakening, as well as to discuss how to best organize the Sangha. Kassapa was a talented organizer and leader, and with the Buddha, he assigned capable senior students to train the younger bhikkhus, just as the Buddha had done in Isipatana. The next day, Nadi Kassapa, Uruvela Kassapa's younger brother, arrived with his disciples in a state of shock. The day before, he and his 300 devotees who lived downstream from Uruvela had seen hundreds of braids and liturgical objects floating in the river, and they feared some terrible catastrophe had befallen the community of his elder brother. When Nadi Kassapa reached Uruvela, it was the hour of begging, and so he was unable to find anyone. His worst fears seemed to be confirmed. But slowly, bhikkhus began to return from begging, and they explained how they had all taken vows to follow a monk named Gautama. Uruvela Kassapa returned from begging with the Buddha and was most happy to see his younger brother. He invited him for a walk in the forest. They were gone for a good length of time, and when they returned, Nadi Kassapa announced that he and his 300 devotees would also take refuge in the Buddha. Both brothers agreed to send someone to summon their brother Gaya Kassapa. Thus, in the space of only 7 days, the 200 devotees of Gaya Kassapa were also ordained as bhikkhus. The Kasapa brothers were well known for their brotherly love and sharing of common ideals. Together, they became deeply devoted students of the Buddha. One day, after all the bhikkhus had returned from begging, the Buddha summoned them to gather on the slopes of the mountain in Gaya. 900 bhikkhus ate in silence with the Buddha and the three Kasapa brothers. When they were finished eating, they all turned their gaze to the Buddha. Sitting serenely upon a large rock, the Buddha began to speak. Bhikkhus, all dharmas are on fire. What is on fire? The six sense organs, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind, are all on fire. The six objects of the senses, form, sound, smell, taste, touch, and objects of mind, are all on fire. The six consciousnesses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, feeling, and thought, are all on fire. They are burning from the flames of desire, hatred, and illusion. They are burning from the flames of birth, old age, sickness, and death, and from the flames of pain, anxiety, frustration, worry, fear, and despair. Bhikkhus, every feeling is burning, whether it is an unpleasant, pleasant, or neutral feeling. Feelings arise and are conditioned by the sense organs, objects of the sense organs, and the sense consciousnesses. Feelings are burning from the flames of desire, hatred, and illusion. Feelings are burning from the flames of birth, old age, sickness, and death, and from the flames of pain, anxiety, frustration, worry, fear, and despair. Bhikkhus, do not allow yourselves to be consumed by the flames of desire, hatred, and illusion. See the impermanent and interdependent nature of all dharmas in order not to be enslaved by the cycle of birth and death created by the sense organs, objects of the senses, and the sense consciousnesses. 900 bhikkhus listened intently. Each man was deeply moved. They were happy to know they had found the path that taught how to look deeply in order to attain liberation. Faith welled in the heart of every bhikkhu there. The Buddha remained in Gayasisa for 3 months to teach the new bhikkhus, and the bhikkhus made great progress. The Kasapa brothers were talented assistants to the Buddha, and they helped him guide and teach the Sangha. Chapter 28, Palm Forest. The morning had arrived for the Buddha to depart from Gayasisa and make his way to Rajagaha. Buruvela Kasapa asked the Buddha to allow the entire Sangha to accompany him. The Buddha was reluctant, but Kasapa explained how easily 900 bhikkhus could travel together. There would be many forests around Rajagaha where the bhikkhus could dwell. They could beg in the many villages there, as well as in the capital city itself, making contact with many local people. Moreover, added Kasapa, the number of bhikkhus was now too large for the population of Gaya to support. Everything would be easier in Rajagaha. Seeing how knowledgeable Uruvela Kasapa was about the situation in Mogoda, the Buddha agreed to let the 900 bhikkhus join him. The Kasapa brothers divided the Sangha into 36 groups of 25 bhikkhus. Each group was led by a senior student. This arrangement allowed the bhikkhus to make ever greater progress on the path. 10 days were needed for them all to reach Rajagaha. Each morning they begged in small villages and ate silently in the forests or fields. When they finished eating, they began to walk again, traveling in their own small groups. The sight of the bhikkhus walking quietly and slowly made a deep impression on all who saw them. When they neared Rajagaha, Uruvela Kasapa led them to Palm Forest, where the Supatita temple was located. Palm Forest was only 2 miles south of the capital. The next morning, the bhikkhus took their bowls and went begging in the city. They walked single file in their small groups, taking calm, slow steps. They held their bowls serenely while their eyes looked straight ahead. Following the Buddha's instructions, they stood before each house without discriminating whether it belonged to rich or poor. If no one appeared, after a few moments, they moved on to the next house. While silently waiting for food offerings to be made, they mindfully observed their breath. When they received a food offering, they bowed in thanks. They never made any comments about whether the food looked good or bad. Sometimes the layperson making the offering asked the bhikkhu a few questions about the Dharma, and the bhikkhu answered thoughtfully to the best of his ability. The bhikkhu explained that he belonged to the Sangha of Gautama the Buddha, He would speak about the Four Noble Truths, the Five Precepts for the Laity, and the Noble Eightfold Path. The bhikkhus always returned to Palm Forest by noon to share their meal in silence before listening to a discourse on the Dharma given by the Buddha. Afternoons and evenings were reserved for meditation practice. Thus, after the noon hour, no one in the city saw the saffron-robed bhikkhus. By the end of 2 weeks, most of the city was aware of the presence of the Buddha Sangha. On cool afternoons, many laypersons came to Palm Forest to meet the Buddha and to learn about the way of awakening. Before the Buddha had had a chance to visit his friend, the young king Sinhiya Bimbisara had already learned of the Buddha's presence. Sure that this new teacher was the same monk he had met on the mountain, he mounted his carriage and ordered it driven to Palm Forest. Many other carriages followed his, for he had invited over 100 highly regarded Brahmana teachers and intellectuals to join him. When they reached the edge of the forest, the king stepped out of his carriage, accompanied by the queen and their son, Prince Ajatasattu. When the Buddha was informed of the king's arrival, he and Uruvela Kassapa personally went out to greet him and all his guests. All the bhikkhus were seated in great circles in the earth, waiting to hear the Buddha's Dharma talk. The Buddha invited the king, queen, prince, and other guests to be seated too. King Bimbisara introduced many of the guests, but sometimes had to ask a Brahmin to introduce himself. Among the guests were many scholars well-versed in the Vedas and belonging to many different schools of religious thought. Most of these men had heard the name of Uruvela Kassapa. A number of them had even met him before. But no one had ever heard of the Buddha. They were surprised to see how reverently Kassapa treated the Buddha, even though Gautama Sakya was so much younger than Kassapa. They whispered to one another, trying to figure out whether Gautama was Kassapa's disciple or Kassapa was Gautama's disciple. Aware of their confusion, Uruvela Kassapa stood up and approached the Buddha. He joined his palms and spoke clearly and with respect, "Gautama the Enlightened One, most precious teacher in this life. I am Uruvela Kassapa, your disciple. Allow me to offer you my most profound respect." And he prostrated himself before the Buddha 3 times. The Buddha helped Kassapa stand up again and asked him to sit by his side. There were no more whispers among the Brahmins. Indeed, their respect increased as they looked out over the 900 saffron-robed bhikkhus sitting with awe-inspiring solemnity. The Buddha spoke about the way of awakening. He spoke about the impermanent and interdependent nature of all things in life. He said that the path of awakening could help one overcome false views and transcend suffering. He spoke about how observing the precepts could help one attain concentration and understanding. His voice resounded like a great bell. It was as warm as springtime, as gentle as a light rain, and as majestic as the rising tide. More than 1,000 people listened. No one dared to breathe too loudly or rustle their robes for fear of disturbing the sound of the Buddha's wondrous voice. King Bimbisara's eyes grew brighter by the moment. The more he listened, the more he felt his heart open. So many of his doubts and troubles vanished. A radiant smile appeared on his face. When the Buddha concluded his Dharma talk, King Bimbisara stood up and joined his palms. He said, "Lord, from the time I was young, I had 5 wishes. I have now fulfilled them all. The first wish was to receive coronation and become king. That has been fulfilled. The second wish was to meet in this very life an enlightened teacher. That has also been fulfilled. The third wish was to have a chance to show respect to such a teacher. That wish has now been fulfilled. The fourth wish was to have such a teacher show me the true path. That wish has now been fulfilled. And the fifth wish was to be able to understand the teaching of the Enlightened One. Master, this wish has just been fulfilled. Your wondrous teaching has brought me much understanding. Lord, please accept me as your lay disciple." The Buddha smiled his acceptance. The king invited the Buddha and all 900 of his bhikkhus to have a meal at the palace on the day of the full moon. The Buddha gladly accepted. All the other guests stood up to thank the Buddha. 20 of them expressed the desire to be accepted as the Buddha's disciples. The Buddha and Uruvela Kassapa accompanied the king, queen, and little Prince Ajatasattu back to the edge of the forest. The Buddha knew that in less than a month, the rainy season would begin, and it would be impossible to return to his homeland. Therefore, he resolved to remain with the 900 bhikkhus in Palm Forest for another 3 months. He knew that after 3 months of practice, the Sangha would be strong and stable enough for him to depart. He would leave in the spring, the season of clear skies and tender new plants. King Saniya Bimbisara began at once to prepare for the reception of the Buddha and his bhikkhus. He planned to serve them in the great palace court paved with fine bricks. He called to his people to deck the streets with lanterns and flowers to welcome the Buddha and his Sangha. He invited a great many other people to attend, including all the members of the government and their families. Children close to the age of 12-year-old Prince Ajatasattu were invited too. Knowing that the Buddha and his bhikkhus did not allow others to kill for their sake, he ordered that only delicious vegetarian foods be prepared. They had 10 days to prepare for the reception. Chapter 29. Dependent Co-arising. Throughout the following weeks, many seekers came to the Buddha and asked to be ordained as bhikkhus. Many of them were highly educated young men from wealthy families. The Buddha's senior students performed the ordination ceremonies and gave the new bhikkhus basic instruction in the practice. Other young people, women as well as men, came to Palm Forest and took the three refuges. One day, Kondana gave the three refuges to a gathering of nearly 300 young people. After the ceremony, he spoke to them about the three precious gems, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Buddha is the awakened one. An awakened person sees the nature of life and the cosmos. Because of that, an awakened person is not bound by illusion, fear, anger, or desire. An awakened person is a free person, filled with peace and joy, love and understanding. Master Gautama, our teacher, is a completely awakened person. He shows us the way in this life so that we may overcome forgetfulness and become awakened ourselves. Every one of us contains Buddha nature. We can all become a Buddha. Buddha nature is the capacity to awaken and transcend all ignorance. If we practice the way of awareness, our Buddha nature will shine more brightly every day until one day we too shall attain total freedom, peace, and joy. We must each find the Buddha within our own heart. The Buddha is the first precious gem. The Dharma is the path that leads to awakening. It is the path that the Buddha teaches. The path that helps us to transcend the prisons of ignorance, anger, fear, and desire. This path leads to freedom, peace, and joy. It enables us to love and understand all others. Understanding and love are the two most beautiful fruits of the path of awakening. The Dharma is the second precious gem. The Sangha is the community of persons practicing the way of awakening, those who travel this path together. If you want to practice the way of liberation, it is important to have a community to practice with. If you are all alone, difficulties along the path may hinder your realization of awakening. It is important to take refuge in the Sangha, whether you are an ordained bhikkhu or a layperson. The Sangha is the third precious gem. Young people, today you have taken refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. With the support of these refuges, you will not wander aimlessly, but will be able to make real progress on the path of enlightenment. It has been 2 years since I took refuge in the three gems myself. Today you have vowed to travel the same path. Let us rejoice together that we have taken refuge in the three precious gems. Of course, these gems have been present in our own hearts from beginningless time. Together, we will practice the way of liberation to allow these three gems to shine from within us. The young people were greatly encouraged by Kondana's words. They all felt a new source of vitality surge within their hearts. During these same days, the Buddha received two exceptional new disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana, into his Sangha of bhikkhus. They were both disciples of the famous ascetic Sanjaya, who lived in Rajagaha. Sanjaya's devotees were called Parivrajakas. Sariputta and Moggallana were close friends, respected for their intelligence and open-mindedness. They had promised each other that whoever attained the great way first would immediately inform the other. One day, Sariputta saw the bhikkhu Asaji begging in Rajagaha, and he was immediately drawn by Asaji's relaxed and serene being. Sariputta thought to himself, "This appears to be someone who has attained the way. I knew such persons could be found. I will ask him who his teacher is and what his teaching is." Sariputta quickened his pace to catch up with Asaji, but then stopped himself, not wanting to disturb the bhikkhu while he was silently begging from house to house. Sariputta resolved to wait until Asaji was finished begging before approaching him. Without making himself noticed, Sariputta followed Asaji. When Asaji's bowl was filled with offerings and he turned to leave the city, Sariputta joined his palms in respectful greeting and said, "Monk, you radiate such peace and calm. Your virtue and understanding shine in the way you walk, in the expression on your face, and in your every gesture. Please allow me to ask who your teacher is, and at what practice center you reside. What methods does your teacher teach?" Asaji looked at Sariputta for a moment, and then smiled in a most friendly manner. He answered, "I study and practice under the guidance of the Master Gautama of the Sakya clan, who is known as the Buddha. He is presently dwelling near Supatita Temple in Palm Forest." Sariputta's eyes brightened. "What is his teaching? Can you share it with me?" "The Buddha's teaching is deep and lovely. I have not grasped it fully yet. You should come and receive the teachings directly from the Buddha." But Sariputta implored Asaji, "Please, can't you share with me even a few words of the Buddha's teaching? It would be so precious to me. I will come for more teaching later." Asaji smiled and then recited a short gatha. "From interdependent origins, all things arise and all things pass away. So teaches the perfectly enlightened one." Sariputta suddenly felt his heart open as though it were being flooded by bright light. A flawless glimpse of true Dharma flashed before him. He bowed to Asaji and quickly ran to seek his friend Moggallana. When Moggallana saw Sariputta's radiant face, he asked, "My brother, what has made you so happy? Can you have found the true path? Please tell me, brother." Sariputta related what had just happened. When he recited the gatha for Moggallana to hear, Moggallana also felt a sudden flash of light illuminate his heart and mind. Suddenly he saw the universe as an interconnected net. This was because that was. This arose because that arose. This was not because that was not. This passed away because that passed away. The belief in a creator of all things vanished in this understanding of dependent co-arising. He now understood how one could cut through the endless cycle of birth and death. The door of liberation opened before him. Moggallana said, "Brother, we must go to the Buddha at once. He is the teacher we have been waiting for." Sariputta agreed, but reminded him, "What of the 250 Parivajraka brothers who have long placed their faith and trust in us as elder brothers of the community? We can't just abandon them. We must go and inform them of our decision first." The two friends made their way to the Parivajraka main gathering place and explained to their fellow practitioners their decision to leave the community and become disciples of the Buddha. When the Parivrajakas heard that Sariputta and Moggallana were about to leave them, they were grieved. The community would not be the same without these two elder brothers. And so, they expressed their desire to follow them and become disciples of the Buddha too. Sariputta and Moggallana went to Master Sanjaya and told him of the decision of the community. He entreated them to stay, saying, "If you remain here, I will transfer the leadership of the community to you both." He said this three times, but Sariputta and Moggallana had made up their minds. They said, "Respected Master, we embarked on the spiritual path in order to find liberation and not to become religious leaders. If we do not know the true path, how can we lead others? We must seek out the Master Gautama, for he has attained the path we have long sought for." Sariputta and Moggallana prostrated themselves before Sanjaya and then departed, followed by the other Parivrajakas. They walked to Palm Forest, where they all prostrated before the Buddha and asked to be ordained. The Buddha spoke to them about the Four Noble Truths and accepted them as bhikkhus in his Sangha. After the ordination ceremony, the number of bhikkhus in Palm Grove numbered 1,250. Here ends Book One.